This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And only for the month of January, earn up to $550 extra when you sell with The RealReal. That's right, up to $550 extra. Go to TheRealReal.com to get started. Earn up to $550 extra this month at TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
From the unexplained to the mundane, come join us on a journey to the fringe. Hello and welcome to Journey to the Fringe, where if we ever did make a documentary on the making of Journey to the Fringe, I think we would have to call it Journey to the Fringe. And I feel like any documentary after that on the making of the last one would just keep adding to that. There would be an endless cycles of Journey 2, which I think at some point we might have to do, but at this point I'm not that ambitious. We are your Strictly podcast hosts for now, Taylor and Chelsea, and tonight we are stepping into the life of a man who lived in two worlds at once. The man we're going to be looking at today is Emanuel Swedenborg.
I've never heard of him, I don't think.
No, you haven't? He's kind of a forerunner of a few things that we talk about, but I kind of want to leave that as a surprise as we go. Without much more, just get right into this.
Okay. Fair enough.
Because Emanuel Swedenborg refused to stay in one lane. He was an inventor who sketched flying machines long before airplanes, a scientist who mapped the human body in ways that anticipated modern neuroscience, and a mystic who claimed he could walk freely between heaven and hell. His story is one of visions, revelations, and ideas that unsettled both church and state. Now, Emanuel Swedenborg was born in Stockholm, Sweden on January 29th, 1688. He was the son of Jesper Swedberg, a pastor in Sweden's Lutheran state church. At 11, Emanuel entered the University of Uppsala. When his father left to become bishop of Skara, Emanuel remained, completing his studies in 1709.
What's his last name?
At this point, it's Swedberg.
Okay.
It does change, which is a little confusing.
It's funny that he's in Sweden and his name sounds like Sweden.
I know. In fact, I think his last name means Swedenborn. I don't know for sure. I didn't look it up, but I think that's what he ends up getting as a last name.
Okay. Okay. Strange.
And also, I find it interesting. Yeah. And I find it very interesting he was able to start university at 11. I don't know what the curriculum was like back in the day. Maybe that was normal.
I missed that one.
Okay. His dad was a professor there, so maybe that's how nepotism works.
I would be more expecting an 11-year-old to be at university if his dad taught there.
Yeah, interesting. It doesn't come up all that often anymore.
No.
Now, like many wealthy young Swedes, he embarked on a grand tour of Europe after this. In England, he studied astronomy under John Flamsteed, the royal astronomer, and moved in the same circles as Isaac Newton and Edmund Halley. He dabbled in geology, botany, zoology, and mechanics, later continuing his studies in Amsterdam and Paris. After more than 5 years abroad, he returned to Sweden and became assistant to inventor Christopher Polum. This connection brought him to the attention of King Charles XII, who appointed him to the prestigious Board of Mines. When Charles XII died in 1718, his sister, Ulrika Eleonora, ennobled the Swedenborg family, giving them the name by which Emanuel is remembered today, Swedenborg. Because he got a favor, he was liked by the king. His sister ended up giving them a new title, a new last name.
I mean, they just added an N.
More or less. That would be so weird these days if, like, I don't know, Prime Minister of Canada calls you up and he's like, hey, I think you're doing a good job. You're getting a new last name.
Yeah, we're just going to add, like, a few extra letters.
We're going to add Canada to the start of your name or something like that.
I don't know that I would like that.
It would be weird.
I think I'd be like, no, thank you.
It's a different culture.
I like my country and all, but
I have my signature down. I don't want to have to introduce myself with extra. That's three extra syllables.
I don't know that I need it as a part of my name.
Could it be silent, perhaps?
Yeah. I'm sure it could, actually, knowing how English works.
In these early years, Emanuel Swedenborg poured his energy into science and invention. He launched a journal, Daedalus Hyperboreus, meant to showcase Poulam's work, the inventor he was working under, but also filled it with his own ideas, including a design for a flying machine. Yes.
The inventor that he was working with, his name was Poulam?
Poulam. Like P-O-L-H-E-M.
I was like, what the hell's up with this episode?
Nobody was named but countries back in the day. At least the people who survived. They went on to found countries.
Just needed to clarify that quick. Mm-hmm.
Included in the journal was his design for a flying machine, which is in the early 1700s.
Oh, I love that.
I think it's a beautiful... Chelsea, I'm just going to share my screen because there's actually a picture of his flying machine that he has sketched. And if I can find where I need to be. Oh.
I love how unaerodynamic these flying machines used to be.
Yeah.
They're pretty clunky. Oh, wow. What is that? Is that a blimp?
I'm not quite sure how to take it. Like, I think it's one wing and you're like floating underneath it.
Oh.
But it also kind of looks like a blimp from the side.
It does.
So I'm not quite
like
sure which angle we're looking at it. And it's really small writing and it's Swedish writing even if we could read it. So I'm not quite sure how to take it. Anyhow, this flying machine actually has its own entire Wikipedia entry.
Oh, okay.
So he drafted this up in the early 1700s, and there's a conversation between him and Poulam where Swedenborg admits that this contraption that he invented wouldn't fly, but he saw it perhaps as a first step. He specifically wrote, apparently, on this page, "It seems easier to talk of such a machine than to put it into actuality. Perhaps in time to come, someone might know how to better utilize our sketch. Although when the first trials are made, you may have to pay for the experience and not mind an arm and a leg." He also did basically say, like, this wouldn't work with just, like, human power. Like, you'd need something else far before engines had been invented.
What does he mean by human power?
Like, we wouldn't be strong enough to make it fly.
Okay, well, then what's he looking for?
Something that would give it power. I don't know.
More than humans.
Yes. Horses, perhaps.
Like, is he a god man? Or, like, what's he looking
for? Oh, he's definitely a god man, but he's more... He didn't want to pray it into the sky. I think he just thought, like, somebody might invent something stronger than a human at some point that could power it.
Okay.
But I'm speculating here, unfortunately.
Like, I was thinking, like, is he thinking extraterrestrials will come down and strike it with lightning, and then it's... I don't know.
No, this is well before extraterrestrials. This is god times, the 1600s.
Okay.
In 1734, Swedenborg published what's called the Opera Philosophica et Mineralia. It's Latin. It's about minerals because he's on the board of mining. Sometimes he's doing interesting stuff, but a lot of his mid-years where he's super successful is about mining. So kind of a dull guy at this point.
Yeah, that does sound dull.
And he publishes this book. And the second and third ones are called On Iron and On Copper. And they earn the attention for their technical detail throughout Europe. But it was his first volume, Principia Rerum Naturalium, Basic Principles of Nature, that laid the philosophical groundwork for his later explorations of the soul.
Oh, the soul.
He followed this with anatomical studies, including Dynamics of the Soul's Domain. There's a Latin version out of it. I'm not going to attempt it. Which examined the heart, blood, brain, and nervous system. And here Swedenborg began to bridge science and spirituality, describing a subtle spiritual fluid that sustained all living things, an energy he believed that flowed directly from God. But his scientific work was soon interrupted by something far stranger. He has a spiritual crisis. So beginning in 1743, which would make him about 55, I believe, late midlife crisis, but nonetheless he's here, Swedenborg's nights were filled with vivid dreams and visions. He recorded them in his diary, often interpreting them as divine warnings or calls to purify himself. By April 1745, his visions spilled into waking life. Swedenborg claimed he could now see and converse with beings from the spiritual world. And in 1747, he resigned from the Board of Mines, turning down a promotion so he could devote himself entirely to theology. His first major theological work after this is Arcana Coelestia, Secrets of Heaven, and it's appeared in 1749, published in London to avoid Sweden's strict heresy laws, and it stretched across 8 volumes by 1756. In it, Swedenborg argued that the Bible could not be read literally. Instead, every verse contained a hidden spiritual meaning, a correspondence between the physical and the spiritual world. Alongside his commentary, he described the structure of heaven and hell, the lives of angels and demons, and the intimate connection between body, soul, faith, and charity. In 1758, he returned to London with 5 new works: Heaven and Hell, White Horse, Other Planets, Last Judgment, and New Jerusalem. Here, he made one of the boldest claims that the Last Judgment had already happened, not on Earth, but in the spiritual realm, in 1757. He said he had witnessed it himself and that it marked the dawn of a new spiritual age for humanity.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And only for the month of January, earn up to $550 extra when you sell with The RealReal. That's right, up to $550 extra. Go to TheRealReal.com to get started. Earn up to $550 extra this month at TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
In 1759, Swedenborg's reputation as a mystic was about to explode. That summer, while attending a dinner party in Gothenburg, he suddenly grew pale and agitated. He announced that a fire was raging in Stockholm, over 250 miles away, and that it was threatening his home. Hours later, he calmly reported that the fire had been extinguished just three doors down. 2 days later, messengers arrived from Stockholm. Every detail matched Swedenborg's account. In 1760, the widow of the French ambassador to Sweden faced a troubling bill for an expensive silver service. She was certain her husband had paid, but the receipt was missing. After consulting Swedenborg, she dreamed of her husband revealing the receipt's location, and the next day, she found it exactly where the dream had shown. In 1761, Queen Louisa Ulrika herself put Swedenborg to the test. She asked him to relay a private question to her deceased brother, Prince Augustus Wilhelm of Prussia. 3 weeks later, Swedenborg returned with an answer so precise that the queen reportedly gasped, quote, "Only my brother could have known this," end quote. These incidents, widely reported and discussed, made Swedenborg a sensation across Europe, and for the first time, he openly acknowledged authorship of his theological work. But perhaps the strangest part of Swedenborg's legacy is this, Chelsea. In the 18th century, the idea that other planets might be inhabited wasn't as strange as it sounds today. Philosophers like Fontenelle and even Kant speculated about a plurality of worlds, a universe that was teeming with life. But while most thinkers treated it as a theory, Swedenborg went further. In his 1758 book, Earths in the Universe, he claimed not only that other planets were inhabited, but that he had actually met and spoken with their inhabitants through his spiritual journeys. Wow. Each planetary society, he said, reflected different aspects of divine order. This was more than speculation. It was a bold theological claim. Swedenborg suggested that God's creation was far too vast to be limited to Earth alone, and the spiritual destiny of humanity was shared across the cosmos. This is centuries before UFO sightings or science fiction.
It really
Swedenborg
is.
Was already describing encounters with beings from other worlds.
It is more than speculation, but it is speculation at this point.
Not really speculation, because he's saying in his dreams he's talking to people from other planets, specifically in the solar system.
It's still speculation, though.
Well, it's not speculation if you're saying, I have talked to a person from Venus.
In my dreams. You're forgetting that part.
That's not speculating, though. That's grounding it where you got this information from.
Okay.
It would be different if he's saying that I think there's people on Venus because I spoke to them in my dreams. He's like, no, I'm speaking to people on Venus regularly.
In my dreams.
In my dreams, yeah.
I mean, that's not really grounded in reality, though. I could say a lot of things happen in my dreams, and my dreams are crazy.
Oh, no, I'm not saying it's grounded in reality. I'm saying it's not speculation.
Well, the speculation is that there's life on other planets.
Other people are speculating. He's saying it's true.
Okay, I'm not seeing why it's not speculation, but okay.
I guess we're splitting hairs. I'm saying there's no uncertainty in how he's saying it, because it has happened to him. He is sure of it, whereas speculation is kind of like, I think this, which is what the other philosophers of the day are doing.
I would go out on a limb to say that he is thinking that he thinks that.
I don't think we necessarily need to have a semantics argument, I guess.
Okay.
The reason I decided to cover Emanuel Swedenborg, a guy that neither of us had heard until very recently for both of us, for you right about now, is because he is considered the first person to have interacted with other entities on other planets.
In his dreams.
How else, Chelsea? And this is something you see today still, is people saying, like, I'm interacting with these people from the Pleiades, from Sirius B, things like that.
Do you know how much stuff I've done and talked with in my dreams?
I don't know. And I don't know for me either, because I don't remember many of my dreams.
I remember a lot of my dreams, and it is all pretty much nonsense. But I'm out there doing it.
Yeah. And this is the first point we can draw everyone back who has claimed to have spoken with people from other planets to this. This is the first time it ever happens.
I mean, that is a long time ago. I'll give them that.
Not everyone saw Emanuel Swedenborg as a prophet or visionary. To many of his contemporaries and plenty of scholars since, he was something else entirely. Some accuse him of madness, suggesting his visions were hallucinations brought on by illness or stress. Others dismiss his elaborate theology of correspondences as arbitrary, even incoherent, a grand system built on imagination rather than revelation. The famous stories of his seership, the Stockholm Fire, the widow's missing receipt, the queen's private question, were retold across Europe, but skeptics argue they could be explained by coincidence, rumor, or exaggeration. Even within Sweden, his writings were controversial enough to be banned, in fact, and his followers were charged with heresy. And while writers like William Blake and Ralph Waldo Emerson admired him, others found his books unreadable, verbose, and repetitive, and filled with claims too extravagant to be taken seriously.
Well, I'm personally surprised that he wasn't tried as a witch.
Too rich.
Fair enough.
It's not Germany, where it apparently the rich could be taken for it.
What I do find strange about it is, where would the inspiration for this come from? Like, it doesn't seem anything in his background other than religion, maybe.
His dad was a pastor, like, the religion's in him from deep, and I do just think it might be maybe a midlife crisis mixed with some weird dreams. Remember, these are back in the days where religion was a lot more literal and everywhere, so if you did get a dream, God was sending you those dreams.
Well, maybe you can put more stock in his dreams than I was putting, because where else would he have heard something like this? But I don't know what they're doing in this time.
There are theories out there at this time that basically every planet, every star, everything has life on it. The universe is teeming with life.
Yeah.
So it's not unheard of to think of there being inhabitants of other planets. It's just he's the first to say he met them and talked to them.
Okay, I like him.
So in the years that followed, Swedenborg published some of his most influential writings, Divine Love and Wisdom, Divine Providence, Revelations Unveiled, and Marriage and Love, the final of those being in 1768. Divine Love and Wisdom explored the very nature of God, arguing that God's essence is both love and wisdom, the source of all life. Divine Providence tackled free will, evil, and the hidden spiritual laws that govern existence. Revelation Unveiled returned to his method of uncovering the Bible's inner meanings, this time focusing on the Book of Revelation. Here, Swedenborg introduced what he called memorabilia, vivid accounts of encounters with angels, demons, and spirits. And then there was Marriage of Love. Despite its title, it was not just about earthly marriage. Swedenborg described true married love as the highest spiritual bond, one that continued beyond death. In heaven, he wrote, a man and woman who are truly compatible will recognize each other instantly and unite as one spirit. For Swedenborg, who was never married, this teaching may have carried personal weight. All of Swedenborg's theological books were written in Latin and published outside of Sweden, most often in London or Amsterdam. This was deliberately strategized to avoid Sweden's strict censorship laws, which forbade publishing anything that contradicted the teachings of the Lutheran state church. But in 1769, two of his followers were charged with heresy after promoting his ideas in Swedish. During the trial, Swedenborg's work was scrutinized. In 1770, the verdict came. His books contained doctrinal errors, but were not outright heretical. Still, they were banned in Sweden, and his followers lost their teaching posts. Partly in response, Swedenborg began his final great work, True Christianity, in 1771. It was both a defense and manifesto, laying out his vision for a, quote, new church, end quote. Not a sect, but a new spiritual age in which humanity would grasp divine truth more directly. True Christianity would be Swedenborg's last book. The main text was printed in Amsterdam, but he traveled to London to prepare a supplement. It was never published in his lifetime. In December of 1771, he suffered a stroke. Though he partially recovered, he seemed to know the end was near. In February, when a friend suggested meeting in 6 months, Swedenborg replied, quote, "That will be impossible, for I shall die on the 29th day of the next month."
And?
True to his word, Emanuel Swedenborg died on March 29th, 1772, at the age of 84.
Hmm.
Jeez. U.S. wasn't even a country at that point.
Do we talk about what he was talking in his dreams to these people about?
I'm trying to keep it an overview of everything. I'm not going too specific into that.
You know, the other night I had a dream that Jupiter was falling out of the sky and the world went into chaos. I just want to put it out here for the listeners.
Okay.
Being as the topic of this episode.
Just a non sequitur, of course.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And only for the month of January, earn up to $550 extra when you sell with The RealReal. That's right, up to $550 extra. Go to TheRealReal.com to get started. Earn up to $550 extra this month at TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
Editor's note here from Taylor. I've realized that it's probably important to actually have quotes of what Swedenborg said about other planets and their inhabitants, so I decided to add a few in the editing process. So, without further ado, Swedenborg wrote about many of the planets and their inhabitants. Of Mercury, he wrote, "The spirits of Mercury are very intelligent. They care little for material things, but are eager to learn about spiritual and natural matters. They said that on their Earth, they do not speak much, but transmit ideas by a kind of thought speech. They mocked Earth's reliance on books. They made jokes about pieces of paper on Earth, knowing things that the people there do not know." Of the people of Venus, Swedenborg wrote of two kinds of inhabitants. One is savage, more than the rest of the inhabitants of the other Earths. The other kind is gentle and humane. The savage group lived in forests and preyed on others, while the gentle group lived separately and were devoted to worship. Of the inhabitants of Mars, he wrote, "These are the best of all in the solar system, for they are in greater obedience to the Lord than the rest. They acknowledge and adore him, and rejoice to be instructed by angels." Of Jupiter, he writes, "The spirits of Jupiter are of a mild and gentle disposition. They detest hatred, and in their world, they live in mutual love. They said that they do not allow anyone to speak of God except in human form, for they know that the Lord alone is the God of heaven and earth." They also were described as living simple lives and avoiding luxury and focusing on spirituality. Of the inhabitants of Saturn, he writes, "They are upright and modest. They live apart from worldly cares and are content with little. They are interior men, thinking more than speaking." He also claimed they were deeply contemplative and spiritually oriented. He also wrote about meeting beings from beyond our solar system. He states that there are innumerable Earths in the starry heaven, each inhabited by human beings. The end of creation is the human race from which heaven is formed. Swedenborg has a huge legacy and influence that moves forward from 1772. Swedenborg's writings didn't end with his death. In fact, they sparked a movement that rippled through art, literature, and philosophy for centuries. Like I said earlier, the poet and artist William Blake read Swedenborg early in his career. Though he later criticized him in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, Blake still called Swedenborg, quote, "a divine teacher," end quote, and wove his ideas of heaven and hell and correspondence into his own visionary art. In America, Ralph Waldo Emerson and the Transcendentalists drew inspiration from Swedenborg's sense of nature as a living symbol of the divine. Emerson praised him as a, quote, "colossal soul, whose writings opened a new way of seeing the spiritual in the everyday." Helen Keller was another surprising admirer. She credited Swedenborg's writings with shaping her understanding of the afterlife and giving her some comfort and clarity about the spiritual world. Even legendary folk figures like Johnny Appleseed, John Chapman, was a devoted Swedenborgian.
Was Johnny Appleseed a real person?
Oh yeah, he was.
He was?
Although everything he planted was cider apples, not actual eating apples. So,
I can't complain.
He carried Swedenborg's books across the frontier and shared them with his settlers. Writers as diverse as Honoré de Balzac, Jorge Luis Borges, and Robert Frost all engaged with his ideas, finding in Swedenborg a bridge between imagination and eternity. So while Swedenborg may have been dismissed by some as a dreamer, his influence has been anything but fleeting. His vision seeded the imagination of poets, philosophers, reformers, and mystics, proof that his strange journey between two worlds continues to inspire. Swedenborg's influence didn't stop with poets and philosophers, though. In the 19th century, his visions were rediscovered by a very different audience, the occultists and spiritualists of the Victorian era. For these seekers, Swedenborg was more than a theologian. He was a proto-occultist, a man who had mapped the invisible worlds long before seances and spirit circles became fashionable. His doctrine of correspondence, the idea that every physical thing mirrors a deeper spiritual reality, became a cornerstone for mystics who wanted to read the universe as a vast symbolic text. The Theosophical Society, founded in 1875 by Helena Blavatsky, HPB, drew heavily on this idea. Blavatsky herself called Swedenborg, quote, the greatest among the modern seers, end quote.
I could see that.
And his descriptions of layered heavens and cosmic laws resonated with her visions of a universe governed by hidden spiritual hierarchies. Aleister Crowley, though rarely citing him directly, inherited much of the same esoteric soil. Swedenborg's layered heavens and existence on personal spiritual experience echo in Crowley's ceremonial magic with a K. Meanwhile, the Fox sisters, whose spirit rappings in 1848 ignited the spiritual movement, were often compared to Swedenborg as the man who had already mapped the afterlife they claimed to contact. And Daniel Douglas Home, the Victorian medium, famed for levitations and seances before royalty, was cast as Swedenborg's showman heir, bringing to life in drawing rooms what Swedenborg had described in books.
Literally everyone we've covered.
Yeah. He is the forefather of all of them.
The funny thing.
At the same time, the emerging New Thought movement, with its emphasis on the power of mind, positive thinking, and the unity of spirit and matter, found in Swedenborg a kindred spirit. His insistence that divine energy permeates all life and that thought itself shapes reality became a kind of blueprint for metaphysical healing and self-transformation. By the late 19th century, Swedenborg's books were circulating not just in churches, but in occult libraries, seance parlors, and esoteric study groups. To these readers, he wasn't a relic of the Enlightenment. He was a toolmaker, someone who had left behind a set of maps and symbols that could guide mystics, mediums, and visionaries into the unseen. In this way, Swedenborg became a bridge, a scientist mystic of the 18th century whose writings fueled occult revival of the 19th century and whose ideas still echo in spiritual subcultures today. By the end of his life, Emanuel Swedenborg had written volumes on science, theology, and the afterlife. He was praised as a visionary and dismissed as a madman. But perhaps the most startling part of his legacy is this. Centuries before UFO sightings or modern science fiction, Swedenborg claimed to have met beings from other planets in our own solar system. To him, the universe was alive with countless worlds, each inhabited, each part of a vast spiritual order. So was he a prophet of cosmic truth or a dreamer lost in his own imagination? That's for us to decide. What's certain is that Swedenborg's visions of heaven, hell, and even life beyond Earth still challenge us to wonder how thin the boundary really is between the known and the unknown. So he's an interesting guy that neither of us have heard of.
He's inspired pretty much everyone we've done an episode on. Well, not everyone. We've done more than four episodes, guys.
Yeah. The occult side.
That's super interesting. I can't believe how far back that goes. I'm still having trouble wrapping my mind exactly what the hell just happened and why he inspired so many people, because basically he dreamed it. And by that logic, I'm a seer. I'm an important seer the way that I dream.
The important part of seeing is telling. And he told about his seeing.
See, and I only got one idea out on this episode, but I promise you guys I'll be sharing more.
Oh, good.
I think that's what everyone's thinking.
Okay.
It's so interesting, actually. I don't think he's an asshole. He might be. But
if our modern day concept of assholes within our reviews can really dissect people from this era. I just don't think we can.
No, I don't think so. We don't have enough information.
The witch people. The people who hunted the witches did that, and they just burned them.
Yeah, they did so without fully knowing whether or not they were an asshole. I think the witch burners were the assholes, to be honest with you, because they didn't fully find out if they were assholes or not.
I really hope that's not the twist we're leading up to with Journey to the Fringe.
Me too. I guess we'll find out in our dreams. Well, I will. You won't, because you don't remember your dream.
Unless you tell them. But if you dream that, just don't tell them, okay, please?
I guess I won't tell them, but
okay.
Who's to say? I might share freely, just like that last one. Maybe I shouldn't have told you that Jupiter falls out of the sky. Maybe it was better you didn't know.
And with that, I have been Taylor, here with Chelsea. We are Journey to the Fringe. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Journey to the Fringe. If you have liked what you have listened to, please like, share, subscribe, or follow, depending on what venue you are listening to us through. Also, please, if possible, leave a 5-star review, as that really helps us in the algorithms. Should you wish to interact with us, please check us out on your social media of choice. I bet you we are there. And if you really want to communicate with us and give us ideas for new episodes or tell us that we're wrong and terrible, either way, please send us an email at journeytothefringe@gmail.com. For now, I'll see you in the next episode.